This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hello, hello. We're going to use the magic of radio to fly around to garden rooftops in Brooklyn, USA, a magic fruit farm in Quebec, and small acres restored in Nottingham, UK. Buckle up. As global oil becomes more expensive and then runs out, major urban centers need to figure out their local food supplies. We find a solution in Brooklyn, New York. Anastasia Cole Plakius is the vice president and founding partner of Brooklyn Grange Rooftop Farm. Anastasia, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for doing the show, Alex.
When and how did your project get going?
We started planning our flagship farm in the fall of 2009. We being a group of individuals, like-minded folks who really wanted to create a fiscally sustainable model for urban agriculture in, you know, cities that were more and more densely populated, where ground level space was less and less available.
And it looks like there are four major operations. Why don't we take them one at a time? Could you please describe the Brooklyn Navy Yard Farm?
Yeah, the Brooklyn Navy Yard Farm is our second farm. It is a 65,000 square foot rooftop farm in, of course, the Brooklyn Navy Yard. That being a very important partnership, of course, because the Navy Yard is an incredible beacon for sustainability here in New York City. It is a manufacturing hub, but very, very focused on green manufacturing. So when we were in touch with them a couple of years ago about possibly working together to build a rooftop farm on one of their buildings in their 300 acres of property, we decided to apply together for a grant from New York City, which was offering grants in stormwater management. Green roofs are an incredibly beneficial piece of infrastructure for cities with rapidly aging infrastructure. And stormwater management happens to be a huge challenge here in New York City, which has a combined sewer system. So the Brooklyn Navy Yard was funded in part by a grant from New York City, a green infrastructure grant in stormwater management, because our farms manage roughly 1 million gallons of stormwater a year.
So I expected to find container gardening on these roofs, but a video on your website seems to show a virtual dirt field right on top of the building. Why not container gardens?
Well, when you are leasing space by the square foot, when you have as limited space as we do on our rooftops are 43,000 square feet and 65,000 square feet, respectively, so about an acre and an acre and a half. You really don't want to lose even a centimeter to containers. They can also really add weight, but more than anything, you know, we really wanted to create an ecosystem that functions as naturally as possible. And the microbial life of that soil is something that we are constantly working towards supporting and, you know, in an effort to get to a place where it supports itself.
How do you know these gardens won't cause damage to the building or even collapse the roof?
Oh, we always engage a structural engineer and or an architect to certify that the building is strong enough to support the weight of the farm. We typically look at huge industrial buildings. Most of them are pre-war, and we're typically talking about a solid concrete slab roof. But our buildings are absolutely certified to support far in excess of the weight that we are placing up there. And we are looking at the saturated weight of the soil, of course.
Well, sure, people park cars on roofs. Surely we could get some gardening going on up there. So, Anastasia, just to give our listeners the picture, how much produce can you get from your rooftop farm operations?
Yeah, it's an interesting metric and one that I struggle with. It's about 20,000 pounds of produce, but of course that's not a very, anyone who grows themselves can say, you know, it's not a very telling metric, because of course 20,000 pounds of tomatoes is very different than 20,000 pounds of salad greens, which is the bulk of what we produce. We find that cut green leaves grow incredibly well in our soil. They're incredibly flavorful. And, of course, they are a short shelf life crop. So we can really offer great value to the community by offering up this product that, you know, when it's being shipped from long distances really suffers in quality. Ours, of course, is typically harvested mere hours before it's brought to market or delivered to the retail store or restaurant. So, you know, we really are able to deliver a very high-quality salad green. We grow a lot of arugula and, of course, a full diet of roots, fruits, flowers, you know, stems, all different shapes, colors, and nutrient values, because we do want to be able to offer this full diet, not just to our customers, but to ourselves and our families. We really have focused more and more on what we do well as the farm matures.
Yeah, I could see restaurants really coveting that fresh produce. It'd be great for their tables.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're actually finding more and more that we're being asked to come and build these farms for restaurants so that the chefs have their own fields in which to develop and grow crops for their own kitchens. Not many restaurants have, you know, 65,000 square feet of rooftop, but you'd be amazed what you can do. Well, I have a feeling you wouldn't, Alex. I think you probably have a pretty good idea. But for those who are listening who aren't growers, you really would be amazed at what you can do in just a small amount of space.
And I expect you have a mother farm somewhere to provide plants and so on. Is that the purpose of that flagship farm on Long Island?
No, that farm is actually in Long Island City, which is in Queens, and it is a hop, skip, and a jump away from Midtown Manhattan. And that is just like the Navy Yard farm, it's a rooftop that's planted parapet wall to parapet wall, covered in soil, and we do actually start a number of our seedlings in a greenhouse. We have a big, beautiful greenhouse at the Brooklyn Navy Yard that is just packed to the brim right now with seedlings, but of course, a lot of those greens that I mentioned are direct sown crops. So we actually use the Johnny's cedar, just a push cedar. We're a real woman and man powered farm. Everything's done by hand up on the farm. So, we do definitely start a lot of our seeds in the greenhouse, which is what's happening now, and then transplant them out into the field. But a good number of our crops are direct sown.
Is this organic growing?
Yeah, we never use any chemical fertilizers or pesticides. You know, again, I can't stress enough how much we really rely on this produce to keep ourselves healthy and well. And we do feed this produce to our families. And of course, New York City is our city. It's our home. And it's one that we strive to make a greener and healthier place. So we would never want to contribute chemicals to that ecosystem or to our own bodies or to the bodies of the people who support us every day by buying our vegetables. So we actually do enjoy a fairly rigorous compost program at the farm. It's a really wonderful way to reduce some of the organic waste that we are pumping into the waste stream here in New York City. You know, we're just starting to pilot some municipal compost programs here in New York City. But for the most part, we really don't have a whole lot of composting options because there are so many challenges to composting, of course, in urban areas. A big one being, of course, pests. And that really turns a lot of people off from composting. So not only do we recover as much as we can of the almost, I think it's about 18% of what we throw away in New York City are organic food scraps that could be repurposed as nutrients for our soil. We do recover as much of that as possible, but we also really aim to teach and help develop compost programs in people's homes, offices, and just, you know, show everyone that with a simple worm bin, you can really, really compost a lot of food scraps without creating a mess or a smelly pile that attracts pests. So we're actually about to launch our workshop schedule for the season, and we're very excited to be offering some compost workshops at the farm.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock as we find solutions for cities to raise more of their own local food. Our guest is Anastasia Cole Plakis from Brooklyn Grange, where they farm rooftops in New York City. In another special operation, Anastasia, you also have beehives. Tell us about the Brooklyn Grange Bees Apiary.
Yeah, bees are just such incredible creatures, and one that I think we're really going to be hearing a lot about in the years to come. you know, of course, nobody's quite sure what's causing colony collapse disorder, the huge challenge facing beekeepers and bees today. But bees are disappearing in alarming numbers, and there's some speculation that seems more and more likely that it's a combination of factors, pesticide use and other agricultural conditions that is causing, you know, these bees to suffer. So I think, you know, everybody's going to continue to see bees coming up in the news in the coming years. But the bottom line is we can't have food without our pollinating friends. And bees are just the best pollinators on the farm. And one of the things that's just so wonderful about keeping bees in the city is that you really don't face a whole lot of agricultural pesticide use in the cities. So our bees tend to be incredibly happy and healthy and prolific. The amount of honey they produce is just amazing. And it's really tasty. You know, you'll find that New York City honey all has a shared quality. The spring honey in particular has a pronounced mentholated quality, a minty note, almost like a eucalyptus. And that's actually the linden trees here in New York City. We have a great many linden trees. And the linden honey is, it's unmistakable. If you've had it before, you can recognize it anywhere. You know, we really think that beekeeping is just such a great, it's really a gateway activity. And so many of the youth who visit our farm come to the farm with these preconceived notions, you know, namely that worms are disgusting and soil is dirty, that it's dirt that you have to wash off your hands. And of course, bees are absolutely terrifying. This is something I can really relate to as I did grow up here in New York City. And as a kid, I was quite scared of bees. But, you know, most of the kids who visit the farm, they leave having completely changed their minds and really believe when they leave the farm and head back to their classrooms or their homes, they leave with this renewed interest and this belief that bees are worthy of protection. And that's work that we cannot directly take credit for. We actually partner with a nonprofit organization called City Growers. And City Growers has hosted to date over 10,000 youth at our two locations for educational explorations and workshops and visits to the farm. So we're incredibly fortunate to have such amazing and dedicated partners doing such incredible work to open up the minds of urban youth and get them thinking about how they can reinvent their own cities.
You brought up so many great points there. I just want to interject one thing. People may wonder if honey contains pollution from the city, and I can tell you my friend at the University of Exeter, toxicologist Paul Johnson, tested honey from hives on a rooftop in downtown London. He found the honey was completely free of harmful chemicals. The bees purify their honey no matter what the pollution, and I think that's just another amazing thing about them. So if some of our listeners want to get a taste of New York City honey, can they do that?
Absolutely, yeah. We have two farm stands every week on the weekends. On Saturdays, we actually have an open house right up on our Long Island City farm location. So you can just head on up with the family. City Growers team is up there with some free, fun, farmy activities for the whole family to enjoy. We'll be selling produce, our own hot sauce made with our own peppers and herbs, and, of course, our rooftop honey. And then it's a great opportunity to enjoy the green space. And whether that's, you know, whether you want to jump in and get your hands dirty and help us turn some compost, or whether you prefer to just kick back and enjoy, you know, a rare bit of greenery in this concrete jungle of ours, there's really something for everyone to do. So we strongly encourage everybody. We're going to start the open houses up again in mid-May. All that information is on our website, brooklyngrangefarm.com.
And how long is your growing season in Brooklyn?
You know, it's been a heck of a late winter this year, Alex, and I think we're all getting a little bit squirrely. We really want to see that germination rate pick up a little bit just because we've had some really, really cold nights. And up until last week, I want to say, it was just, there's just so much cloud cover. Typically, we grow April through October, and recently with the later winters, we've been pulling carrots out of the ground as late as the week up until the holidays. So we really do have a little bit of a longer growing season, and, you know, that's in part because cities just tend to be a bit warmer due to urban heat island effect, you know, all that heat that gets trapped here in cities. I'm so glad that you raised the point about pollution and honey. It's a question that I get often, and when I don't get it, I wonder if people are just being polite. You know, is that food safe to eat grown in cities where there's so much pollution? And actually, we've engaged in an air quality study with Cornell University, and we're just amazed to see just how pure that air is up on the roof, because so much of the pollution that we deal with here in cities is particulate matter that's heavier than air. So we are really protected being up as high as we are, and we definitely urge backyard gardeners to get their soil tested before planting in it. But if you can't plant edibles, it doesn't mean you can't plant something. So plant some flowers for those bees. Grow whatever you can, wherever you're growing it. There's always something that you can grow.
Now, Anastasia, as you know, until the recent opening of some farmers markets, there has been a shortage of fresh produce in African American and other ethnic neighborhoods. Do you see that your program could help with that, or an expansion of it could help with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the future of urban farming, we're really looking at a number of different methods and modes of producing food in cities. And I think that right now we're still in a very exploratory period. And I don't want to look at this too much through rose-colored glasses. There is a limit to what cities can produce, and we will never be entirely self-sufficient. We will always, always rely on our rural counterparts, the folks who've taught us so much of what we know about farming and to whom we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude. So, you know, we really should always remember that, particularly for meat, dairy, grain, and you know, and feeding a growing population, I don't want everybody to think that we'll be able to do that just on the rooftops of cities alone. But we can really grow a lot more than what we are right now, and we can get people involved and feeling like they are a bit more autonomous, a bit more that they have some agency in the way they are feeding themselves. And I think that's so important. A lot of the food deserts in New York City really contribute to a lot of the health crises that we face, the diabetes crisis. And I think a lot of it is that it can be a bit exhausting to have to think so much every time you are hungry. Sometimes it's easier to just reach for the nearest food. So often that means fast food. It means packaged food. It might, here in the city, mean a bodega that's just stocked with chips and candy. So the more fresh produce that we can bring into underserved areas of the city, the better. Again, you know, it might not be a large-scale commercial rooftop farm that works for your space, but school gardens are popping up everywhere, and it's just wonderful to see. So we really hope to see different methods, hydroponics, aquaponics, cropping up in cities around the world in the future.
I think Havana, Cuba is kind of a model for that. When they got cut off from their oil supply, they did manage to feed a large part of the city from gardens in and around the city itself. Now, you do your own radio show on the Internet Heritage Radio Network. What do you cover in Anastasia's Fridge?
Oh, Anastasia's Fridge is a really fun collaboration with our friends over at Heritage. And you know, Heritage Radio and Heritage Foods, which is a wonderful company, they're really incredible partners in here in New York City's food world and really all around the country, just in terms of providing a voice for farmers, activists, you know, and really pushing everybody to connect. I, in particular, am grateful to them for an opportunity to just really geek out about vegetables. I happen to be a home cook myself, and there's nothing I love cooking more than vegetables. So Anastasia's Fridge is just a quick little review of what's fresh right now, maybe a little bit of its history or cultural significance, and then a recipe for people to try at home with that ingredient.
Are you in contact with other urban farms in other cities? Is there a conversation place or a site for that?
You know, there's definitely a couple organizations doing really wonderful work. The National Young Farmers Coalition is really just an amazing, amazing resource for folks who are just getting into farming, especially as we lose the traditional cultural trajectory of the family farm, you know, knowledge passed down through generations. I think that they will continue to be a really important resource. And, of course, the Greenhorns as well are really focusing their energies on young folks who are new to farming. Our friends at Stone Barns have a really wonderful site right now called the Virtual Grange, and I think that's a pretty fantastic way for farmers to get some information. But for the most part, you know, farming in a digital age is a beautiful thing. And I can't tell you how many times a day we pick up our phones, our cell phones out in the field, and phone a friend, and ask, about a disease symptom that we're seeing on a plant or their best strategy about battling a certain pest. And then, of course, the internet, just having access to Google. Actually, Google satellite images are how we found our sites for our farms. So we really can't underestimate just how fortunate we are to be farming in this day and age. And then, of course, just the network on Twitter and Facebook and all the social media sites, it really allows people to be generous in sharing information. And that is so much what we need to focus on in the coming years. All farmers have a responsibility to also be teachers and really help that flow of information increase in power and really gain momentum.
Well, that's a good place to wrap it up. I could talk to you for an hour, and maybe someday we'll do that. I'll put a bunch of those links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. And could you just, as we finish up, give us again your website and your Facebook page for the Brooklyn Grange Project?
Yes, it's brooklyngrangefarm.com. We can be found at facebook.com/brooklyngrange. We're also on Twitter and Instagram for those of you who have desk jobs and you want to follow along from work.
Great. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest has been Anastasia Kolplakis, the vice president and a founding partner of Brooklyn Grange Rooftop Farm in fabulous New York City. Thank you so much, Anastasia.
Alex, thank you so much. Will you come visit us next time you're in town?
I would like to do that, and I want to get a taste of that honey.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We'll definitely make it happen. Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We're up against a challenge greater than any in history. What is possible? Maybe we should check that out at possible.org. Our next guest is Olivier Asselin. He's a filmmaker and freelance photographer, recently back from years in Africa, now in the Canadian province of Quebec. He set out to make a film about permaculture. That sounds simple enough, but along the way, Olivier discovered it's a big task with many fertile directions. Olivier, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
You made a transition from humanitarian causes abroad to permaculture here. Why?
Well, I haven't completely stopped working with humanitarian organizations. I still take on some occasional assignments abroad. But I discovered permaculture a couple of years ago, and it just opened my eyes to a lot of solutions. Instead of just seeing the problems, it just made me start to see solutions. And it really inspired me to try and share that inspiration that I found. So that's why I decided to start working on this project.
Well, do tell us about your current project. What are you working on?
Okay, well, I started a website called possible.org. Originally, the idea was to produce a documentary film to try and present a wide array of solutions of things that people were doing in different places in the world so that other people just like them could see that and be inspired to do the same thing or similar things. And the idea was to present such a great diversity of ideas and initiatives that just about anybody could see something that they could do, you know, because there's things like eco-building, urban agriculture. A lot of it is centered around permaculture also, but it's not exclusively that. And, you know, not everybody's going to go out and build their own eco-home, and not everybody's going to go and want to grow their own food. But the idea was to show a wide diversity of things so that just anybody could see something they could do. And as I started working on it, I realized that there was just so much and so many different things that I could talk about that it became, I was having a hard time seeing how it could be all made into a short film. So I decided to just create this website and present as I went, edit the material into short clips, basically. That for me is more accessible and more immediate as a format than a long form film. You can come, you know, to find something about urban agriculture, and then you see all these other ideas that are also short films. So instead of working now on a feature documentary, I'm still working on the project, but as ongoing short videos.
We're going to run audio from one of your film clips, an idea for permaculture orchards, but that's just one of several videos you have up at possible.org. Could you tell us about one or two other ones?
Sure. Well, there's that the permaculture orchard. There's one about a couple that decided to grow vegetables in their front yard and ending up in a battle with the city that ended up in them reversing the bylaws to allow front yard gardens. There's one about a couple who built their own earthship home in north of Montreal. There's one about a woman who started an sustainability training center in a home she inherited. We have about 10 or 12 videos right now. It's been a little bit on the back burner the last few months because I've been working pretty hard on an educational film based on one of the videos that I filmed for possible.org. That's the permaculture orchard. So this is about to come out in a month, I would say. And then I'm going to start working in a bit more seriously on possible.org.
Yeah, that whole front yard garden thing is amazing. When I was a kid in Toronto, the Italian immigrants had lots of tomatoes and all sorts of food growing in their front yards. And some Canadians looked down at them for it. And now we're saying, hey, these people are cool. They know what they're doing. We should be learning from that. So I'm hoping those bylaws will be thrown out wherever they are as people need their own food. You know, Olivier, we don't hear enough about what's going on in the Quebec alternative agriculture scene. It's quite progressive there. Who are some of the people that you found in Quebec that you think the rest of the world needs to hear about?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm not looking just at Quebec. I've been covering ideas and meeting people also in New England so far, and I'm trying to expand a little bit beyond the borders of Quebec, actually, because I feel that here, because of the culture and the language, sometimes we're a little bit self-centered. And I think the same thing goes for pretty much anywhere in the world. But I think we have so much to learn when you go outside of your immediate area. While I think that the solutions to the big problems that we're facing are definitely local, we can learn a lot from what is being done elsewhere. And that's also one of the things that we plan to do in the coming months. Which we're looking right now at establishing a funding model that would allow us to commission people to create these videos from ideas from different places in the world. So that would scale up a little bit things.
Yeah, there could be some cross-pollination, say, with Africa. You know, permaculture could help in Africa, but some places in Africa, like the date palm oases, those are already sustainable agriculture. They've been there for 1,000 years, some of them. So I could see a lot of chances for ideas to cross back and forth.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I know of locations in Africa right now where there is actually permaculture projects ongoing already for a few years. And I know places in Latin America, actually some regions I feel in South America are much ahead of us in terms of starting to experiment with these things. I think we have this idea that in the humanitarian world or development industry, you know, that people from the rich countries go and teach people from developing countries these things. But I think we might have a lot to learn from them as well.
I couldn't agree more, and I would love to hear more about what's happening in South America. I think we need to learn a lot from what's happening there. You employed Kickstarter to get seed money for your film. How did that work for you, and do you have tips for others who would like to do the same?
Yeah, we did the Kickstarter campaign last December. We were originally looking for $15,000, and we raised $24,000, the first day and a half we had $7,000. So the first, there was a big peak in the beginning, and then gradually we went up to $24,000. It was a really good campaign for us because, I mean, we were going to do the film anyway, regardless of the funding. We were going to pay from our own pockets if we had to. But the benefit for me from Kickstarter is that on top of getting your project funded, you get this audience. You find out about these people who already are interested in what you're doing. So even before it's made, then you already have this audience, and these people will talk about it around them. And really the objective for our film is to spread this kind of information around as much as possible. So that's great.
How did you manage to get so many people interested in the first couple of days? How did you promote the idea?
We used Facebook a lot. We went on all the permaculture-related groups and posted the video from the campaign, and we also collaborated with Permies.com, Paul Wheaton, who owns the forum Permies.com. He helped us promote the film a lot, and he actually got himself the Supreme Executive Producer with Bacon, Cheese, and Sparkles credit, which he requested. So, you know, that's that.
What are you going to call your first movie, and when do you expect to get it out there?
Well, the film that we funded through Kickstarter is called The Permaculture Orchard Beyond Organic, and that was actually born from one of the short videos that I filmed for Possible.org, which is about an orchard in southern Quebec here that was started 20 years ago by a man called Stefan Sobkowiak, who bought a monoculture apple orchard and decided to turn it into a permaculture-inspired orchard, which he has. Now he has over 100 types of apples, 20 kinds of pears, plums. It's very mixed and very biodiverse and very low maintenance. He doesn't spray any kind of chemical at all. And so when I found out about him, he proposed to me that we should try and make this film to explain how he did it so that other people could replicate the technique without copying it, you know, exactly, but inspiring themselves from it and then create these kind of orchards everywhere in the world.
You know, I'm hearing from you solutions and even some hope as opposed to despair about our situation in the world. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, well, that's how I felt when I discovered permaculture. I felt this huge wave of inspiration, and I felt like we had to find a way to propagate that inspiration and contaminate others with it. And being, you know, that I'm a photographer and videographer, that's the tool that I have, and I thought it was a good way to bring what I could and make my part. But, you know, I don't know if we should have hope. I don't know if we're going to change the world or save the planet or whatever, but I feel that we have to do something, right, with the time that we have left. And, you know, I don't want to be in cliches or anything, but when people say, you know, you have to live every day as if it were your last, then maybe we are living our last day here. So what are you going to be doing with it?
In addition to your website at possible.org, can you tell us how to find your Facebook page?
The Facebook page, you can, I don't even know actually.
You know, you're not the first guest to say that. So many people don't know their own Facebook address.
Actually, I think it's Facebook/possiblefilm.
Okay, we'll look it up, and I'll put a link to it for sure, and the website, in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info, and that comes out every Wednesday. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with filmmaker and photographer Olivier Asselin, currently in the province of Quebec, Canada. Olivier, thanks for talking with us, and I really appreciate the way that you are sharing your permaculture films.
Thank you.
Courtesy of filmmaker Olivier Asselin, we'll hear the audio from his first short film on the permaculture orchard, founded by Stefan Sobkowiak in southern Quebec, Canada.
One day I can remember where I was in the orchard and looking at this organic orchard. It was wonderful that it functions as an organic orchard, but it doesn't function as an ecosystem. I didn't like emphasizing, well, let's stop the negative. I'd rather take my energy and say, okay, what should we do? So we tore out most of the trees and began replanting in a permaculture design, not a monocultural design, not just an apple tree orchard design, but right away as a mixed planting. So the basis of the design is the trios: nitrogen fixer, then an apple, then a pear or a plum, could be a cherry. And so that nitrogen fixer fixes all the nitrogen or gives all the fertility needed to the fruit trees on either side. That's just the fruit trees. It would also be the fruit shrubs and other plants as well that you put. The great beauty of these planting design in a three different species configuration is that if an insect lands in one, for example, in the apple tree, he can't go into the nitrogen fixer because there's predators there waiting for him. He can't go into the pear, and even if he does, he doesn't affect the pear. And so he's got a far way to go till he reaches the next apple. It's every three trees would be an apple. And the next apple is not even the same cultivar. When we were certified organic, we had 12 cultivars of apples, just apples. Now we have, just in apples, we have over 100 cultivars. We have 18 cultivar pears, several plums, cherries. We have a whole range of cherries, I think about 7 peaches planted, we have pawpaws planted, we have kiwis, grapes, mulberries, small fruit, gooseberries, red currants, black currants, Saskatoon berries. Basically, our goal is anything that will grow as a fruit in southern Quebec, we want to have it. We put both annual and mostly perennial vegetables now in the permaculture orchard. So the goal being, once it's established, we don't have to be replanting. But we still take advantage of spots where we have sun. For example, on the at the base of the honeysuckles, which is our nitrogen fixer, we put climbing plants. So eventually we will have grapes on all of them and kiwi on all of them. But in the meantime, we still can grow cucumbers, peas, and beans. So all our climbers go on our nitrogen-fixing trees. Once all this variety kicks in, once it's getting going and it's established, then the insects come. Then the birds come. We have snakes now, like we've never seen so many snakes. We have all kinds of frogs. One day when the honey locusts were in bloom, I stopped for 10 minutes just to do a survey, a quick survey of what's going on. You could hear the insects in that tree. In 10 minutes, I counted 36 species. Species, not individuals. They were hundreds in one branch. Bees are in big trouble, I hear. Big trouble, huge losses. I wouldn't know. We went from four hives that wintered over. We started with eight in the fall, and there was only four survived. So yeah, there is big losses. We lost 50% of our hives. But we went from four hives to 23 hives during the summer, basically because the bees have so much of an abundance of food through the succession and the biodiversity of trees. The honey locusts flower almost up to the end of June. And in between May 1st and the end of June, there is some tree in the whole succession of trees that is flowering. So that, instead of having 10 days of apple blooms, we now have 60 days of tree blooms before the main honey flow of clover. There is some work, but it's so much less, and the abundance is really there to prove. I have nothing to envy conventional orchardists. I haven't fertilized this block since it was planted in 2007, so that's 6 years. No fertility, no fertilizer. Nobody does that. Everybody fertilizes, not just every year, but sometimes several times in the year. The output is huge, not just in diversity, but in taste. We had an open day this weekend, so people would come and you give them one of these plums, and they go, after they've tasted one, they say, that's crazy. You never taste such a sweet and delicious plum in the store. Of course, the whole system is not geared towards taste. It's geared to shelf life. It's not a system that's geared to giving you the maximum pleasure. And one of my goals for the farm is bringing back the wow in food. We've lost the wow. How often do you get wowed by food in the grocery store? If you go down the row, everything is by a certain date. We function with 10-day windows. So if, say, now we're early September, we're picking in rows that all the trees will be ripe in a 10-day window. It's either the apples or the pears or the plums. They're already in this window. It's efficient because you go down the rows and you can pick. So even if you don't do a direct marketing and somebody wants to pick everything and take it to market, they still only have to go down certain lanes on certain dates. So you can simply have two or three boxes with you, and depending which tree you're picking, you would put it in a separate box. We have huge abundance here, surpluses of all kinds of things. We just had an open day. We are giving 160 pounds of apples to members. Come pick. It's free. That's four bushels. Most people didn't know what to do if they took four bushels. That's part of the abundance. So yes, we think of that ethic of sharing the surplus as sharing with people. And that's true. We should. But we shouldn't forget that that principle really has two sides to it. Sharing the surplus with people and sharing the surplus with nature. We don't need to have the attitude that, oh, we have a certain insect in the orchard that's eating one of my fruit. Oh, we have birds coming and pecking some of my fruit. What's wrong with sharing some of your harvest with them? They're working day and night to take care of your orchard for you. I've had people just walking around shaking their head like they were in a daze because they said, everything I've learned, everything I've done in my orchard is contrary to what I see here. It makes sense what I see, but it doesn't jive with what I know and what I've done. So the future is getting enough people to see that, one, it's possible, two, it's viable, and three, it makes so much sense. Why am I not doing it?
That was the permaculture orchardist Stéphane Subkowiak in a short video by the filmmaker and activist Olivier Asselin. Find more at possible.org. It's a treasure trove of ideas for everyone. Find links to Paul Wheaton's massive empire of permaculture forums and information in my weekly show blog as well at ecoshock.info. Meanwhile, we're off to Nottingham, UK. In our continuing journey to discover more balanced lives, we travel to the hill country of Nottingham inland in North England. Our guest is Rob Carlisle. With his partner Jill, Rob has built a low-energy house. They are refashioning an overgrown woodland into gardens suitable not just for humans, but for all creatures. His blog at sustainablegarden.blogspot was named one of the 10 best garden blogs by Ecologist magazine. Rob, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
Well, could you start by setting the scene? Please describe the general area. What's it like there in North Nottingham?
North Nottingham is mainly a sandy area. Very dry. It's on the dry side of England. Very dry, sort of desiccated soils during the summer. But very temperate, really. Relatively mild. We don't have the excesses of temperature and weather that you guys probably have in parts of the States. So, but it's a pleasant place to be.
Right. And how about your place? How big is it? Where's it?
Yeah. Well, we're just north of the city of Nottingham. We took over this site in 2010. Then it was a six-acre site that had been formerly a mushroom farm. When we took it over, it had been derelict for 20 years. Nothing had been done. Everything was overgrown. There were the concrete bases of the former mushroom sheds in the middle of the site. And really, everything else overgrown with nettles and brambles, all kinds of weeds. And so what we've had to do since that time is build ourselves a couple of bungalows. My sister and brother-in-law have built one as well. And we've cleared the ground, and we're moving towards being sort of as self-sufficient as we can be, but with lots of recognition of biodiversity, so with woodland areas, hay meadow, flower meadow areas included as well. So a busy time for us.
And your new home is half built into the earth, is that right?
Yes, we would say over this side it's earth sheltered. It was one of the planning requirements that the building should be a single story one. And then when we were designing it, we wanted to sort of pay recognition of for homes that are in the Hockerton area of Nottinghamshire, which were amongst the first of the eco homes that were built, and they are earth sheltered. And the idea of that is that by placing the building within the earth, then you are going to have some of the insulation qualities of the earth itself, and also the air turbulence around the building will be limited.
And how far along is it? Have you moved in?
Oh, yeah, we moved in August. We were self-builders. Although we had contractors doing the work, we did most of the work that we could do ourselves. And it's a lovely place to be. We've got an air source heat pump, underfloor heating, highly insulated walls, floors, ceilings, triple glazed windows from Denmark. But it's a lovely place to be, I'll tell you, Alex, a lovely place to be.
Right. So there's been some about that in your blog, but the rest of it is really about work, hard work to recreate nature and utility there. What's your vision for the land around you?
Certainly in Nottinghamshire, we've got very intensive agriculture. So when we look at surveys, say of our common frog, there are whole areas now within the county of Nottinghamshire where the once common frog is common no more. And those are mainly in these areas of intensive arable production. And it seems to me that we should be doing everything that we can to try and redress that. So what we're trying to do here is just create a mosaic of different kinds of habitats in which things like as humble as the frog or the toad, the slow worm, whatever it could be, will find a home here. So we're looking towards creating just a range of different places for wildlife and having some success, I'll tell you, even in these early stages. It's great to see things happening.
And I suppose you also plan to grow your own food. How much of your diet do you think you can supply from your own place?
Well, I don't know. You know, this whole self-sufficiency thing has become, I don't know whether it's the same on your side of the pond, slightly sort of caricatured. It certainly was over here. I don't know. There are certain exotic things that we won't be able to produce. But the basics, I would imagine, which are those things to do with potatoes and brassicas and the sort of staples, we'll be able to produce ourselves.
And one of the helpful features I found in your blog are the photos. We can peer in there to identify some plants that aren't common to nursery supply items. Tell us about just a few of the things that you have planted.
What, the native things or the cultivars?
Your choice.
Yeah, well, I would go for native plants because I've got this sort of passion that local genetic integrity has been lost because we're certainly over in Britain here, we're importing so many plants from the continent. Even those things that we would consider to be natives are coming over from Eastern Europe or from the Netherlands. So what we've been trying to do is, for instance, plant the larval food plant of the brimstone butterfly. I don't know whether you get brimstone over with you. It's the butterfly that gives butterflies their name. It's a lovely yellow insect that flies around early in the spring, and it's hunting the buckthorn bush, Rhamnus cathartica. And it took some tracking down to find some Rhamnus cathartica, particularly because it doesn't establish well on sandy soil. But now we've got those planted this year in a new area of woodland that we're planting. And we're very hopeful that in years to come, the smog that was over England last week will be replaced, certainly in this area, with a yellow smog of brimstone butterflies. I'm ever the optimist, Alex.
And you've taken special care for other creatures, as you mentioned. For example, tell us about the bats and the toads.
Yeah. Well, bats, we seem to begin every sentence these days when we're talking about diversity, saying that this is a species in decline. And it's certainly true of all species of bat over in the UK. They've been affected by the changes in agriculture. They've been affected by the fall in the number of invertebrates. Our people here in Nottingham should tell us that only 10% of the invertebrates around that were in this county 100 years ago. Of course, that has a knock-on effect with bats. New buildings affect bats because they lose the places in which they can roost. So trying to build that up again is a huge job. So that includes trying to have as wide a range of flowering plants as possible, which will in turn attract as wide a range of nocturnal insects as possible, which will then be food for the bats, providing different kind of bat roosting sites, and that's experimental work on our part, just trying to find out what works well. So that's the kind of thing that we're doing with bats, and hopefully we'll be successful. The trouble is that they're around at night when we aren't, so sometimes they're unseen visitors. But I've got my bat detector, and I'm going out echolocating most nights in the hope of finding some of them.
I'm Alex Smith, talking with sustainable garden blogger Rob Carlisle from Nottingham, UK. This is Radio EcoShock. Rob, getting back to the food garden, do you recommend raised beds?
I say that raised beds are certainly an answer. They don't have to be the complete answer because there are some disadvantages with raised beds. We found that with raised beds, they could become a place where slugs sort of hid. Also can be a place where perennial weeds can sometimes be difficult to get out. But no, I think raised beds have got a part to play. And we're about to put in our own raised beds here as part of the development work, so that we're hoping to be growing those things that we want to get access to most easily from the kitchen in raised beds just by our back door. So, yeah, I think that raised beds have got a part to play.
Can you briefly outline for our listeners how to use the lasagna method of preparing and managing the garden?
Yeah, that's a great method. And actually, that's one that came over to me from America. We haven't got the time to clear all of the ground of those perennial weeds such as nettle and bramble. We just don't have the manpower. There's just one man and his wife doing this work. And neither do we want to use any kinds of pesticides. So we came up with the idea, from looking at information over from the States, of lasagna gardening. And what that really does is that principle of denying the plant light, and eventually it will give up and die. So what we do here is we collect cardboard and lay moistened cardboard on the surface of the soil where the perennial weeds are lying. We have local stables here with plentiful supplies of manure, horse manure. So we use then a good thickness of manure on top of the cardboard. Once again, more cardboard on top of the manure. And then we have local tree surgeons who don't have anything to do with all their chippings once they've taken trees down, so that we get deliveries of chippings, which then go on the top. All of that then slowly decays. During the period of decay, that's when the weeds are denied light. So by the end of a season, you'll usually find that you can dig down. The cardboard has broken down. The manure has broken down. It's rich with brandling worms and other invertebrates, and just a great place in which you can then plant those shrubs and trees, or whatever it is that you wish to plant. Vegetables could go in there just as easily. I do recommend it.
Why do you try to get compost that doesn't have peat in it?
We've got a real issue over here, and I don't know whether you have. The peat in Britain and Ireland is considered to be a very important natural resource. It's considered to be a place where unique flora and fauna exist. And as we strip that away, we deny that flora and fauna that specializes in peat-based environments the chance to live. So that's the first concern. But the second concern is that peat is just as much a releaser of CO2 as other fossil fuels. Don't forget that peat is actually used as a fossil fuel in many parts of the world. So as we're stripping peat out and using that in potting compost and other things in the garden, we're actually releasing CO2, when actually what we should be doing is locking CO2 up. So I feel very passionately that the future has to be in planting media that don't have peat or peat derivatives in. We've got to find a better way of doing it.
Really, it's like a sort of slow form of coal, and as you say, it releases a lot of carbon. So how do you see your relationship between the blog and the public who consume it and the project and work that you do every day? Should we be blogging about what we do?
I think that we should be taking every opportunity, whether it's blogging, tweeting, or whatever, because I think that there's a message out there that we need to get out more broadly, more widely. One of my concerns, and I don't know whether it's the same for you and your listeners, is that we've got an increasingly urban population, and the real disconnect between the lives and experiences of people who live in largely urban environments and the natural world. I know that I felt some of that when I was at work myself, in that I would be in a centrally heated home, I'd get into my warm car, I would drive to the office, I would get out of my car into the warm office, spend all day in there and do the return journey, and have very little connection with actually what was happening outside, seasonal changes and the bigger things that are affecting us with climate change. So I feel that we should take every opportunity, including, you know, your excellent radio station, to get that message across.
How did you handle the wicked rains this past winter in Britain, Rob?
In Britain, we had a varied experience. Those people down in the southwest of England have had it the worst. Some parts of Somerset, a county in England, only now are beginning to dry out. Less of a problem here. As I said, we're on the drier side of the country and we're on sandy soils. But I think that the message that is beginning to get through, and the trouble is, most of the messages around the environment are long-term, and our politicians see things in a short-term way, is that it isn't just, oh, it's raining heavily, there's a problem. It's all of those things that back up before that. The fact that we've removed trees from the hillsides, which are better able to soak up that rain, that we've culverted rivers and so they flood more easily. We drain rainwater down into drains into rivers and so on. So I think that I'm hoping that lesson, or some of those lessons, are going to be listened to and action taken. But the trouble is, as with all the issues, say around climate change, they are such long-term issues. I sometimes worry that the politicians' view is only of a short period of time, and they aren't able to take a sufficiently long-term view.
Well, the same can be said of corporate CEOs and directors. They just have to produce for the next quarter a good profit, and who cares what happens 20, 30 years from now?
Yeah, absolutely, short-termism. It's a real problem here, isn't it?
And I'm sorry to say most of my programs warn that we are more or less going to hell in a handbasket as we wreck the atmosphere, the land, and the sea. I wonder, is there any personal feeling of at least a bit of salvation in leading a more honest, balanced life closer to nature?
Well, all that I could say to that is that there is a lot of evidence now that people who do have that are fortunate enough to be able to sort of, shall we say, commune with nature, if you like. I mean, there's stuff on our radio stations about, believe it or not, the health benefits of listening to birdsong, the health benefits of gardening, the health benefits of the exercise that comes from gardening, the fresh air and so on. So I do have to be, you know, I am a member of the, fully paid up member of the Optimist Club. I do believe that we're going to have to see the light at some point. And it just is that radio stations such as yours and my blog in its own small way, we just need to keep banging on, keep on keeping on. And eventually, we've got to hope that message gets through.
Well, for our listeners, please give us the address of your blog.
Yeah, it's http://sustainablegarden.blogspot.com. sustainablegarden.blogspot.com.
We've been off to Nottingham, England to chat with one of the more popular garden bloggers on the web, Rob Carlisle. Find a link to his sustainable garden blog and my own show blog at ecoshock.info as well. Thanks, Rob. It has been fun talking with you.
Yeah, it's been excellent. Thank you, Alex.
Radio EcoShock.
That's our tour of Growing Solutions this week on Radio EcoShock. You can suggest guests anytime using the contact form on the show website at ecoshock.org, or you can email me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Let's do it. Let's make a permanent culture, one that can last to replace the tottering throwaway world we have right now. Well, this is the last time I'm going to hassle you. We're wrapping up our April fundraising drive. That's where I try to raise enough money to pay the bills right through the summer months when people tend to take off. I hate asking, but it costs money to make all our past and present programs available as free MP3 downloads. That's so important, don't you think, to get the word out in these underreported issues? Literally thousands, sometimes tens of thousands, of Radio EcoShock shows are downloaded every month of the year, and that takes bandwidth and that costs money. And I also have equipment to replace and general costs like long-distance telephone calls all over the world for 20 or 30 minutes at a time, studio rent, and all those sorts of things. There are two ways you can help this program continue. The very best is to take on a sustaining membership, which is $10 a month. That lets me budget. It gives me some security even during the lean months. You can do it by clicking on the membership button on the About page at ecoshock.org. So go to ecoshock.org, click on About, and you'll see how to do it right there. If you prefer, a one-time donation of any amount is also very welcome. You can do that from the website or from the show blog at ecoshock.info. I may not have time to thank each of you individually. I'm pretty busy trying to make a radio show here, but I want you to know it gives me heart and determination when listeners are willing to help, even in these tight times. In fact, to any of you that I have missed thanking, don't think I ignore your donations. I appreciate you very much. Even if you're not in a position to help financially, it means a great deal that you're willing to donate your valuable time to listen to this program each week and to get informed on truly important issues of the day, so don't feel bad if you can't help. You can still assist me by tweeting, Facebooking, or otherwise passing on the news about Radio EcoShock, and links to the show so others can listen? We need to build a critical mass, a growing wave of consciousness and demand for change, one human at a time. That's what it's all about. Get links for today's show at my weekly blog, ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for caring about your world.